As the old 16 line went through Mission Beach, it was on its own right-of-way. The streetcar company owned that right-of-way until they sold it sometime after 1941 or 1940-41, somewhere along in there. And the car line was quite high. If you got on in Mission Beach, you had to take a very high step and pull yourself up with the handrail that was there. It was no place for little old ladies. And the old streetcar line to La Jolla ran out on Kettner until it veered over a block or so to the west, I guess the direction would be, and went over this high bridge, a spidery affair, on which the streetcar took the highest of three roads, let's say, three places to travel. There was never any accident there, but it was always a spidery-looking affair. We used to say that we should say three Hail Marys before we started up.
Zelma Locker, former librarian at the California Room and author of the article Remember Old Number 16, Recollections of the La Jolla Streetcar Line.
As he started to leave, I took hold of his sleeve with my hand.
John D. Spreckles owned the entire streetcar system in San Diego for many years. He had also bought out Elisha Babcock's interests, including the Hotel Del Coronado, and in fact acquired extensive holdings in this city. Dana Basney points out that one would be hard put to find an important area of basic urban development that Spreckles was not involved in.
It's a very interesting way all of these entities which he had are interrelated to the development of the city. Now, the streetcars had a power plant with a very modern generating system, which is still in use by San Diego Gas and Electric today on the corner of Broadway and Kettner in downtown San Diego. And it's through the streetcars that he got into the electrical power production field. He had excess power, and so he went into form what became the beginnings of San Diego Gas and Electric Company. So he controlled the utilities there. On the Hotel Del Coronado, when it was built, it was not built by Spreckles, it was built by Mr. Babcock, but it also had a power plant. So he sort of by default got into the power business through buying out the Hotel Del. Now, incidentally, the Hotel Del was the first totally electric hotel to be built in the world. And it had to have its own generating system, and the supervision of that, the installation of the generating system in the Hotel Del, was performed by Thomas Edison himself. Now, in relation to the Hotel Del, he also got into the water business. When Babcock built the Hotel Del, you could not have a first-class, respectable hotel without having mineral springs. Mineral springs were quite the rage in those days, and the health and curative powers of these mineral waters were very, very widely advertised. Now, it was very difficult to have a mineral spring on the island of Coronado because Coronado is a desert island. There isn't a drop of fresh water to be had on, above, below, or anywhere near it. So what Babcock did, he built the upper Otay Dam and the lower Otay Dam and built his own water company. And they piped the water underneath San Diego Bay to the Hotel Del, where they had an actual little spring house. And this was advertised as being a mineral spring with great curative powers. And in essence, or in fact, it was nothing but the Otay water, which was piped underneath San Diego Bay. So by buying the Hotel Del, Spreckles got into the water supply system business, and it just expanded. As he could see the city's needs for water expanded, he built the Marino Dam, and he built several other dams. He developed a water supply system for the city of San Diego, which was sufficient to supply the city at that time for 7 years, if not one drop of rain fell. San Diego had a population of about 30,000 people, and yet as a result of the water supply system which Spreckles built, it had a bigger reserve of water than the city of San Francisco, which had over 300,000 people, 10 times as many people. And he was very much in the forefront of developing the water supply system before the need arose. He was ahead of his time in building the water supply system because he saw it as being a basic necessity, which San Diego definitely was lacking, and he realized that if it was ever to become a major center of importance, you had to have an adequate supply of water. And he was the first really to solve the water problem for San Diego. And there had been a perpetual problem with any development in San Diego, and it had really kept the city from developing beyond the Old Town area, which was on the banks of the San Diego River, was the problem with water, and he managed to solve that.
He also was responsible for having a number of buildings built in the downtown area. And how did he happen to get into that?
Well, at one time, Spreckles owned virtually all of Broadway from the foot of the pier, which he from which he ran his steamship company. He had a steamship company which went up to Los Angeles, and he had the pier to dock his vessels. And he owned all of Broadway up to about 7th Avenue. Now, among the buildings which he built in San Diego were the Spreckles Theater, which is one of the few things in town today which bears his name, and he built what's now known as the Bank of America building. He also built the San Diego Hotel, which is still in existence in San Diego. He built the Union Building, which has recently been torn down to make way for a new skyscraper. Now, he also built a very plain building in San Diego called the Golden West Hotel. And this building was built of reinforced concrete to the same safety standards as the rest of the buildings he built. But it was built as a workman's hotel. And it was built primarily to house the workers that he brought in to build the railroad into San Diego. And it was designed as a very economical building for them to live in while they were working on the railroad. I think that of the buildings that he built, probably the most interesting in many ways is the Spreckles Theater. The Spreckles Theater is supposed to have one of the most acoustically perfect theaters in the country.
Was designed acoustically so that from every single seat in the house you can hear perfectly everything being said on stage.
Jeff Schlaes is presently involved with the efforts to refurbish the Spreckles building. It stands at Broadway and 2nd downtown. The building is both an historic site and a rental facility for many offices. The theater is a frequent site for musical and theatrical performances. Jeff Schlaes says that the Spreckles Theater is indeed an acoustic marvel. His mother, Jacqueline Littlefield, is the building's owner. She inherited it from her father, who had a number of theaters in the downtown area. She has brought the building and its theater to life with interior facelifts, and many of the intricate Rococo designs in the theater and the onyx walls of the lobby have been returned to their original appearance. The building, she says, was built to last a long time.
Well, according to the archives, the newspaper article dated August 23rd, 1912, which is a Leo, stated that the Spreckles building was earthquake-proof and fireproof. And of course, this would go along with the fact that he came down here and away from the earthquake area and would have been extremely conscious of what might occur under other conditions. The building has been exposed and been on the perimeter of 28 quakes. And according to the seismic, an engineer from the seismic committee, any building that withstood all of that and all the excavation around it was here to stay. You actually can't find a crack in the building to speak of.
And fireproof, you said it was fireproof
it
as well.
The underwriters for the fire insurance people told my insurers that this building never needed to be sprinkled because there was nothing to burn. It's pretty incredible considering when he built it. But I would say that he put absolutely the best of everything in here For instance, I think we had a $76 plumbing bill last year. In other words, there are, and I cross my fingers, very few breakdowns in plumbing, which would indicate an amazing plumbing job.
Where might Spreckles have sat? Would he have sat in one of these side pieces when he came to see the theatrical productions that went on in his lifetime?
Well, if he was anything like myself, he would have wandered and watched and looked and taken any seat that wasn't filled.
Jacqueline Littlefield, owner of the Spreckles Building in downtown San Diego. Let's talk about downtown San Diego. Claire, what role did these buildings that Spreckles constructed have in establishing what the shape of downtown San Diego would be like?
Well, they certainly had a tremendous effect on San Diego. You remember that Alonzo Horton had made Fifth Avenue the main street in San Diego because he built a wharf at the foot of Fifth Avenue, and then all of the buildings that were constructed along Fifth Avenue from Broadway on going down south to the wharf were, of course, the most important places in town. Well, Spreckles, more than any other single individual, simply changed all of that. First thing he did when he came to San Diego in the 1880s, he got a franchise from the City Fathers to build a wharf, and he built it at the foot of Broadway. So that immediately made the foot of Broadway an important area. And then when Spreckles moved here to San Diego himself, he bought up this property, virtually all of the land fronting on Broadway for 6 or 8 blocks, and then constructed a series of buildings so that he made Broadway into the main drag of San Diego, the main street where all of the social and business life took place. And ironically, I suppose that's one of the reasons that we still have Fifth Avenue, what's now called the Gaslamp Quarter, that we still have many of those buildings here. It's that part of town was left alone, and Broadway became the main street, so now we still have some of the buildings that can be restored along Fifth Avenue.
Well, the downtown area, I'm thinking particularly about Horton Plaza and the area south of Broadway, really is a tenderloin district, one of several in the city of San Diego. And I'm curious what it was like in the 1900s. Was the kind of outfit that I'm thinking of typical in the early days of San Diego as well?
Well, of course, the Stingaree District, which is what the Tenderloin District would be called, the place where the prostitutes, the drug traffic, and so on. This was in the south of Broadway area and close to Fifth Avenue. And Elizabeth MacPhail wrote a delightful article in the Journal of San Diego History a few years ago called "When the Red Lights Went Out." And she described the great red light raid of 1912 that took place in the Stingaree District. And in her article, she reproduced the newspaper of the time with this marvelous headline about 138 women have been arrested, and then sub-headline and smaller type is two promised to reform. The others apparently were told that they would not be prosecuted if they left town, and it was observed that they all went down to the railroad station and bought round-trip tickets to Los Angeles. And so when they came back, as many of them did, apparently they simply dispersed their activities elsewhere in San Diego, and it's almost as if history were repeating itself. This is one of the complaints that some people are making about the efforts to crack down on the dirty bookstores and X-rated movies that are in the Gaslamp Quarter area now. People are saying, well, if you shut them down there, they are simply going to move into other parts of the city, and, you know, we don't want them here. We don't want them in, let's say, Golden Hill or University Avenue or Point Loma.
Now, for a very interesting look at downtown San Diego in this period, I'm talking about the 1920s, we visited with Bob Johnston. He's been in town about 60 years. He runs a bar now and has been involved with show business and burlesque theater. I spoke with him at his Palace Buffet at F and 3rd Streets. That's in the Grand Horton Hotel, one of the oldest downtown buildings. Along the walls of the inside of his bar are photos of familiar faces of show business, boxing, politics, horse racing, that have been a part of the palace's history. And with the din of a full bar, an occasional jukebox tune, and a billiard game in the background, he told of a rapidly changing downtown San Diego, of which he's long been a part.
Oh, it seems like it's raining all over the world. Oh, heaven. That's a nice shop, brother.
This was built in 1887, so it must be pretty, 90 years old. And I've been in this block 60 years myself. I've owned this bar for about 40, and owned the Hollywood Burlesque when it was running burlesque for 55 years. That was the only real stage show in San Diego at the time. I had no competition. And burlesque got a bad, it had a bad name, but it wasn't as bad as, it was just the name. People said burlesque, they think they shouldn't go. But what I see now on television and in movies, I think burlesque was like a church. When I run a burlesque show, we couldn't say hell or damn. That was, the law would pinch you for that. And then they said burlesque was bad. I can't see it was bad. It was just the idea of a girl was taking off her clothes. She never went nude, so how could it be so... The less you see, the more you wanted to see. You know, the olden days when a girl used to step on a streetcar, you know, that's before your time, when they had the old hobble skirts, you used to have to lift them up to get on the streetcar. Everybody would be looking at that just to see an ankle. And now you walk down the street nude, nobody would even look at you. It wouldn't make any difference. But things have changed quite a lot in 50, 60 years. San Diego was a pleasant place to live, very nice place. Yeah, I don't think you wish any better. Like, the climate is beautiful. What more would you want? And you didn't have to have much in those days to live. If you didn't have much in those days, you made yourself $20, $30 a week. You was making a pretty good salary. And food was cheap. You could eat for 15, 20 cents in restaurants. Get a room for a dollar a night. What more do you want? See? And things are a lot different. I think I like the olden days better. I think the time that I liked the best was in the 20s, in the roaring 20s.
Bob Johnston, from his Palace Buffet at 3rd and F Street downtown. As we earlier discussed the development of the railroad, it was mentioned that Spreckels saw our harbor as the key to the success of San Diego. This took on special significance when the idea of a canal across the Isthmus of Panama was first discussed, which would make San Diego the first natural harbor to the north on the western side. Well, was this an important factor to San Diegans? Did they say, aha, there's going to be a Panama Canal, this is going to put us on the map?
Oh, very definitely. And this went back, of course, to around 1905, 1906, something like that, when the canal was already under construction. And it was seen as a way of developing the economy further in San Diego. And so to attract attention to San Diego, the concept of an exposition was talked about. And the discussion of an exposition, as far as really getting public support and so on, probably... began about 1909. Chamber of Commerce and various other people got together and began to raise funds so that they could develop a big exposition in San Diego, and this would advertise it widely, put San Diego on the map as a port, as a place to come and enjoy the beauties of the scenery and climate. And the exposition was planned, of course, for the park.
Many prominent business leaders, therefore, showed an interest in the exposition. Spreckels was one of them. Again, Dana Bassney.
Now, the idea of this exposition came about when San Francisco planned a similar exposition to attract the attention of the world to the fact that this was going to be the major port for the newly opened canal, and it was going to become a very prosperous area. Well, Spreckels wasn't too happy about having San Francisco be the get the limelight in the opening of the canal. So he supported a building of a exhibition in San Diego. I believe he donated outright $100,000 to the San Diego Exposition in 1914. And he also built the Spreckels-Ogden Pavilion at a cost of about $110,000 at that time and donated to the city.
Ogden Pavilion in Balboa Park continues to provide entertainment with free concerts every week. This year saw the appointment of a new civic organist, Jared Jacobson, a young man whose interest in the Spreckels organ goes back several years when he first saw the instrument. The organ he plays is unique, as is the position he holds.
Well, this post differs completely in that it's the only civic organist job in the United States, as far as I know. In Europe, especially in England, almost every village and dale has a town hall with some kind of pipe organ in it, so there are numerous civic organ posts in England, but not in the United States. And this is also the only outdoor organ that's used year-round, and it's the largest, so this post is fairly unique.
What is your impression of this fine old instrument?
Oh, it's fabulous. It's just fabulous. It's like driving an old car or walking in an old mansion. Everything works, with the exception of a set of drums and a set of cymbals. It's like stepping into another era. And it's, again, absolutely unique in that respect. There are problems playing outdoors because of the traffic noise and, you know, people playing frisbee in the back of the auditorium or whatever, but that's all sort of put into the equation of playing in the park. And it may seem like you don't really get to play for many people, but in the course of a year, you know, thousands of people wander by and at least hear a pipe organ sound.
Civic organist Jared Jacobson, playing the Spreckels organ in Balboa Park. Claire, from the downtown buildings to the Hotel Del Coronado to the streetcar system, the water system, to the railroad, Spreckels, in a very real sense, owned the entire city of San Diego. And I wonder, was there resentment of the power that he wielded through all of this financial control he had over the city?
Well, yes, certainly not everybody thought that this was such a great idea. And in the early 20th century, there was a very strong feeling against monopolies anyway. President Teddy Roosevelt had made trust busting a popular phrase, and Spreckels was certainly looked upon as being, you know, a monopolist, as Roosevelt said of some others, you know, one of the malefactors of great wealth. And there were people certainly who resented the fact that he had this dominant power. He, as you mentioned, owned the transit system, owned the water system that supplied the city of San Diego with its water, and of course tremendous real estate investments, banking investments. And he owned the major newspapers, and so he certainly had control of most of what went into print. There was a rival newspaper, the San Diego Sun, owned by E.W. Scripps, and that was the major organ for criticism of John D. Spreckels.
I'm curious, Claire, what exactly was the nature of the rivalry between Scripps and Spreckels, as exemplified in their consistent battles in the editorial pages of the two newspapers?
Spreckels, of course, stood for the traditional conservative Republican businessman kind of viewpoint, and E.W. Scripps, despite the fact that he had built himself up into being a millionaire personally, his whole newspaper chain was built upon reflecting the viewpoint of what you might call the little man. He had figured out early in life that if he could produce a paper that would sell cheaply that it would have a wide readership. And so Scripps traditionally in his papers took the standpoint of the little man, the common man. So politically, their differences were that Spreckles was a conservative Republican, and the San Diego Union Tribune reflected that point of view. The Scripps papers represented either an independent point of view or a Democratic Party point of view. These were the major differences between them.
And so at every opportunity, the Union and the Sun would attack the other paper and its owner and refrain from printing stories that might be unpleasant to its own boss. These rivalries and the very different way in which newspapers operated in those days are very real to Richard Perrod. He worked for the San Diego Sun until 1939. Then he went on to the San Diego Union. He's now editor emeritus of the Union.
Newspapers in those days were more advocates than reporters. And under Spreckles, they certainly were very much so. And even Scripps had indulged in that. He and Spreckles would fight all the time, one to one side, him and the other one, just because they did. So newspapers were, and the Spreckles people did hide a lot of things that happened here they wouldn't talk about because it involved Spreckles or something. But they were personal organs, there's no question about that. The editorials were personal, and I can recall many things of past that the papers would ignore or do or play down, that they were more expressions of the owners than they are now. But they were, and of course the Spreckles, some of the streetcar accidents weren't reported. I think one time one of the streetcars came down 12th Street and jumped the track and ran into a restaurant or something over there. There was never a word of it in the San Diego Union, you know. But I guess there wasn't a Sun. They'd jump on that big, but the other paper mentioned. But those things are long gone. You can't do that anymore, and there's no inclination to do them. They take the good with the bad now, and even say even run the letters attacking them. Well, you wouldn't do that in the old days and many years ago, and I think newspapers are much better for it.
Richard Perrod, author of a 7-volume series on the history of San Diego, himself a longtime San Diego reporter and newspaper editor. We've seen John D. Spreckles from the point of view of his business dealings, but what was he like? C.J. Stafford remembers doing business with Spreckles. Stafford was once a business partner with William Kettner, a man who is the subject of a future program in this series. They had an insurance business, and C.J. Stafford remembers visits to the Spreckles home in Coronado.
John D. Spreckles, I had naturally had a lot of insurance with the Spreckles companies. And once in a great while, Mr. Kettner and I would go call on him personally. And if we had an appointment at 10 o'clock, Mr. Spreckles was at the head of the stairs, coming down the stairs at 10 o'clock. And he'd say, "Gentlemen, do you want to have a little music?" And he'd go over and sit down on the bench and play a short tune on his beautiful organ.
He had his own pipe organ in the house?
Oh, yes. And just a short amount of music, and he'd turn around on the bench and say, "Gentlemen, what can I do for you, or what is your pleasure?" And I would be the spokesman and present to him what we want. He made it right then. He'd say, "That interests me. Go ahead and write that form of policy or do that. Or I'm not interested." And that was the end of the interview.
San Diego businessman C.J. Stafford. I guess we see in that story a clue as to why Spreckles donated an organ to the city of San Diego. Now, also on the line of interesting personal points about Spreckles, Dana Basney in his research was struck by the great attention Spreckles gave to his personal expenditures, however tiny.
Well, I think the man was kind of a dichotomy. He would develop something for millions of dollars and would not get too concerned with spending the money. And yet, when you go through his personal records, he would keep track of every 5-cent tip which he gave a person. He literally kept a diary or a record of his expenditures for the day, and his companies may have spent $5 million in that day, But he would keep record of every penny that he spent, which made total $3 during the entire day. And it's, I think it was kind of an interesting dichotomy in that he his personal finances, he seemed to have very strict control over and kept very strict records on.
When Speckles came to San Diego, he was already a rich man in his own right. He also stood to inherit millions from his father's holdings. At his peak, it was said that Speckles owned San Diego, and when the breadth of his holdings is considered, that's not really overstating the case. The question we ask now is, why did he do it? What were the motivations behind his many activities here in San Diego?
Well, I think it's very hard to attribute a motive to anybody this many years after their death, but I got the impression that you must remember Speckles' father, Klaus, was a very, very wealthy man and had made a fortune in the Hawaiian sugar business. Now, Speckles, in his own right, became quite successful in the steamship business, and of course he took over his father's sugar interest eventually, or a portion thereof. And when you have literally all the money that you can possibly use, money no longer becomes as much of a motive to people as one might think. I think he was, this is an era of empire builders. We had the railroad barons, we had the idea of manifest destiny and expanding the country coast to coast and just building an empire, an American empire was the wave of the time. And I think he in his own right was an empire builder in that he got a sense of accomplishment from developing this city in so many different ways that I don't feel you can really say that his motives were completely economic. I'm sure that he hoped to make money on his investments in San Diego, but I think his view was in the long run. I think that if he had lived longer, he would have realized an economic gain from his investments. But I think his primary motivation was just the satisfaction of getting something accomplished, and I think he had a vision of a great metropolis, and I think he worked towards that vision. I really don't think he was, I frankly don't think you can justify a lot of things he did on an economic basis, unless you have a very far distant way of measuring return. Certainly in the short run, I think he was an intelligent enough man that he realized that his chances of becoming terrifically wealthy as a result of these investments were not to occur. But he was terrifically wealthy anyhow. He didn't need the wealth. I think he needed the perhaps ego gratification or satisfaction to feel that he, in his own right, had accomplished something rather than just living off of his father's fortune. And so I think he wanted to accomplish something on his own, and his motives were more than economic, I think.
Dana Bassney. His paper, The Role of the Speckles Business Interests in the Development of San Diego, was his master's thesis at San Diego State University. In summary, what would you say about the Speckles' influence on the development of the city of San Diego?
Speckles was not only a newspaper and transit tycoon, a civic leader, the owner of many different industries, and a civic benefactor. He was a man, I think, with a sense of social responsibility, too. Certainly many people were jealous of the power, the tremendous power that Speckles was able to exercise, and they called it a one-man town, called San Diego a one-man town. At one time, indeed, it was estimated that Speckles, the Speckles properties accounted for 10% of the entire property taxes in San Diego. He employed literally thousands of people in all of the different enterprises that he had when he was building the railroad, for example, running the transit system, the newspapers, and various other activities that he was involved in. But Speckles, I think, did have a sense of social responsibility along with this drive to be a power in the city, to exercise the kind of power that owning all of these institutions and corporations gave to him. But he was certainly a generous benefactor But I think his major effect on the shaping of the city really lay in his development of the transit system, which encouraged the suburban sprawl, and also his other major impact on the shaping of the city had to do with his developments along Broadway. Fifth Avenue had been the main street in San Diego at an earlier time, but after Spreckles began to build his handsome structures, including the Spreckles Theater, which of course is still there, along Broadway, then Broadway became the main street of San Diego, and in these ways, then, Spreckles left a very memorable impact upon the city.
Dr. Claire Crane, San Diego historian and chief consultant for this series of programs. With John D. Spreckles came many downtown buildings, a railroad, many things important to urban development. But there were others who made different kinds of contributions to the growing city. For example, Kate Sessions, a great horticulturist whose plantings, research, and plant introductions into San Diego have made immeasurable contributions to the beauty of this city. Her life is the subject of the next program in the series. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a series of radio programs on local history, biographies of 12 great men and women who have left their mark on today's San Diego. The programs are heard each week at 12:30 Tuesday afternoon, with a repeat broadcast Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. A resource packet is available with the programs. Send $2 to KPBS-FM San Diego 92182 and ask for the San Diego History Resource Packet. We also welcome your comments on this series. The address again is KPBS-FM San Diego 92182. I'm Peter Hamlin, series producer, thanking you for joining us. 12 Who Shaped San Diego is a production of public radio station KPBS-FM and is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you.